Let him finish,
the Jospoor says.
All of us knew that horn meant more than whatever payday it represented. We should have watched out for it, all of us. And for you and for one another. And we didn't. This, I think maybe this is what separates us from the animals.
Technically, Muftak, I believe your kind may be animals, says the Jospoor.
Nobody likes a pedant,
the Muftak says.
You are not a pedant. You are a know-it-all,
Myos says, and snarls. As Myos' intellectual prowess impresses no one, least of all himself, the table finds itself collectively surprised.
We are all just money to one another. That is all. Today or tomorrow, one day, one of us will be a payday to the other, and we will pounce. I took your stupid thingy, Lirinkarn. Yes, and I knew you were drunk, and I knew you would want it back, and I knew I could get money I didn't have for it. Just as the Muftak knew the same and took it from me, and we would both do it again.
I'm not so sure,
says the Jospoor, looking at the Muftak.
This is the way the world works,
a dejected Lirinkarn says.
Especially at Mos Eisley. Life is cheap, glue horns are cheaper, and money is expensive.
I propose a wager, friends, says the Jospoor. I say Han Solo lives to see the other side of this day, despite unfavorable odds, because he's a man with friends. I say Greedo does not collect his bounty, for Greedo has no friends but for those he pays. The table considers.
The table wonders why.
Let us wager on the nature of the universe. Who wins? The man with friends? Or the man seeking profit at all costs? If I'm right, Lirinkarn, I will pay for your debt to Myo. Myo, I will pay your debt to the Muftak. Muftak, I will pay what you and Kabi owe Akmina in rent. And if I'm wrong, well, Greedo will kill Solo. Evazan will kill the Muftak, or Chalmun will, or, hell, maybe even Myo. Myo will figure out that Kabi took the horn from the Muftak and pawned it, and will probably kill her, being robbed of the chance to kill the Muftak. And Lirin, your debt will remain unpaid. So Greedo, confident with a Wookiee pelt across his chest and Solo's scalp nailed to his wall, will inflict great pain, if not actual death, upon you. For he is now a killer, and killers can never stop once they've started. He'll drain you like a shallow dug well. And when you're dry, he doesn't need to finish the sentence. And I will have to find a new cohort to associate with. Which is a shame, as I've quite come to enjoy this table, for all its foibles. The gathered work through the scenario de Jospoor is laid out, and they realize, one at a time, that he has spoken with unerring accuracy. The Muftak sighs.
I leave now to see a pig-nosed man about a dropped shipment of illicit narcotics.
He turns, then pauses.
I am sorry, Lirinkarn. I'm sorry, Myo.
De Jospoor raises his glass to the Muftak. Wandering through the Mos Eisley crowd, no one feels more friendless in its dim and cool confines than the Muftak. He senses something in his paw. A drink, handed to him by Kabi.
You look like you need it more than me, friend,
she squeaks. And he does. So he drinks. It is cold and smooth and good. It is relief in a tall blue cup. Maybe the just poor is right after all. At the bar, keeping an eye on the door and, one assumes, to just poor, stands Dr. Evazan, and next to him Ponda Baba. Down a piece stands Chewbacca, ready to play backup to the Mooftak as promised, buttressing an expectant space between them being held, the Mooftak knows, for the Mooftak himself. All he can do is insert himself therein and explains to the psychopaths that he doesn't have their drugs or their money. He chooses to steady his nerves with the drink before getting probably murdered, and in the time it takes him to start snuffing the thing down his little protuberant gullet, the teenage girl and the old man take that space at the bar in his place. Ah, the Mooftak sighs. The only thing worse than waiting is being made to wait when you've resolved to do something after you're finished waiting, but now have no control over how long that waiting must last. He responds in the only sane way possible. He drinks slower. Before he's gotten even halfway done, the aquilish lunatic attacks the teenage girl at the bar. And before this registers with anyone in Mos Eisley as anything outside of the positively banal and predictable, the old man ignites the air and slices into Ponda Baba and Dr. Evazan with pure light before they can lay a hand on his daughter's flowing flaxen locks. The chaos lasts half a second longer until the air stops sizzling and the old man and his wee lass head off after Chewbacca toward the smuggler's table, away from the downed lunatics. Chewbacca offers the Mooftak a shrug. Sometimes these things take care of themselves. Greedo, behind the old man and the Wookiee, watching his hired muscle bleed out on the cantina floor, feels his luck shift beneath his feet. Greedo remains too stupid to turn back, and the Mooftak knows the feeling. The Mooftak returns to the table where Liren Karn seethes, watching the band play, and the Joss Poor looks delighted.
Did you know that was going to happen?
He clicks. No. Isn't it amazing? Asks the Joss Poor, who is indeed genuinely delighted. The Joss Poor rises to allow the Mooftak back into the corner seat, keeping Tabi and the Mooftak pinned in between the lamenting Liren Karn and the angry Mayo.
I should be up there, the Bith says.
Where? The bar? You wish to fight as well?
Asks Mayo, attention going to the mild outbreak of excitement, as though the smell of blood holds a tractor beam only a Bissin can feel.
What? No, the stage, the stage. I shall be playing, he says.
I thought you hated music,
says the Mooftak.
I hate being a musician,
continues Liren Karn in a moment of clarity.
Is there a difference?
The Bith leans around to look at the band on what passes for a stage in this dump, playing their jaunty, syncopated trademark tune.
One fills your heart, the other breaks it,
Liren Karn says.
That's insane,
says the Mooftak.
How could anything so beautiful be a burden? You have a gift, a true gift. Had I any sort of talent for anything, I...
A blaster cry breaks the din of Chalmun's cantina, and Greedo, in a booth with Han Solo, slumps over, smoldering, dead. Everyone turns to stare, except for Joss Poor, who stares at the Mooftak. He smiles. The Mooftak scratches his head. With Greedo, Evazan, and Ponda Baba out of the picture...
You are out of a fortune,
he clicks at Joss Poor. Joss Poor shrugs.
Why are you smiling? You've lost the bet, and now owe all of us at least something. I know you do well as a tracker, but none of us do that well.
The Jospur reaches beneath the table, and from behind his legs brings up the clue horn of Lirin D'Avi, who gave it to his son Lirin Karn, who lost it to Mayo, who lost it to the Muftak, who lost it to Kabi, who sold it to a scrapper, who sold it to him. He places it on the table, and everyone shuts up for a second.
"Now that," says Mayo, "is a funny joke."
Night. The knot of the day's events wound and unwound themselves around the necks of many. Some escaped, some did not, and still yet others wanted only to get home in one piece. The Muftak sits at the bar, drinking, each gulp a relief, each sip sweeter and savored more than the last. He finds himself filled with a romance and sentiment toward everything on this particular night. The Muftak, having found himself in love with the entire world, keeps drinking. Fortune eventually smiled upon him some, at least a little bit, at the sabacc table with his friends. He's put aside about half of what the Muftak and Kabi owe to Chalmun to stay in the pipes, and is imbibing the rest, raising glass after glass to the prospect of living to see another day. Nothing tastes as good as the drink Kabi gave him in the bar that afternoon. But the Muftak intends to keep tasting until he finds its equal. When he almost falls off the stool, the Muftak gets cut off. As he rises and staggers in the first of many unstable, uncertain steps toward home, he finds himself supported by Lirin Karn, who escorts him with great care, with great concern, toward where he'll sleep in the tunnels below their feet, dreaming endless dreams of all tomorrow's scores, each one more certain than the last, to be the one that turns it all around. It turns out that sometimes friends take care of one another, even in a place like Mos Eisley. And that makes all the difference in the world.
Added Muscle by Paul Dini. Jabba said to meet him at Docking Bay 94. Told me it was a collection job and he needed some insurance. One look at the duds he dragged along confirmed this. Not a pro in the lot. I'd be lying if I said I didn't enjoy the whispers of surprise when I walked onto the scene. That's right, boys. Fett's here. Do me a favor and fall to the side after you're hit. I really don't want to trip over your idiot corpses once the shooting starts. Oh, sorry. If the shooting starts. No reason to get excited yet. Okay, Wook. There are two ways this is going down. One, we have a nice little chat, Jabba gets his money from Solo, and we all leave happy. Two, someone gets anxious. Zip, zip, Jabba's rid one deadbeat, and I get a new scalp for my collection. No guesses which one I prefer. Originally, I wasn't supposed to be a part of this. That's what I get, I guess, sticking around Tatooine to snag some Imperial coin. I was supposed to be off this dust ball yesterday, but I picked up trooper buzz that Vader was looking for a couple of runaway droids. Figured I'd collect the bounty and square myself with the headman at the same time. He still got a mat on over those rebel spies I crisped on Coruscant. Idiots came at me with ion disruptors. What, they thought I wouldn't carry a weapon accelerator? Flash, boom, three tiny ash piles. Tried to collect, and Lord, no disintegrations refused to pay without bodies. My word's not good enough, apparently. Reckoned I'd make up the loss by finding his droids and holding out for twice the reward. No go on that. Trailed one until its footprints were wiped out by a Jawa sand crawler. Followed those treads away until I found someone had wiped out the Jawas too. Someone, meaning amateurs trying to fake a Tusken raid. Probably stormtroopers judging by the random blast shots. Some might call them precise. Me, I say they can't hit the butt end of a Bantha. At least they had brains enough to take out everyone who had seen the droids. Hard luck on the sizzled hicks I found at that torched moisture farm. Had a look-see and discovered there were three settlers living there, not two. Betting the third ran with the droids. I'll hunt around after I'm done here. Vader may triple the bounty if I bring him the fugitive along with the droids. Yeah, I know. Intact corpse. No disintegrations. Till then, here I stand, adding some credibility to the collection of bums and bugs Jabba calls muscle. Figures he'd want us to shake down Solo, the biggest loser in the galaxy. I could just pop him for target practice. But I never work for free. Twerp? You're really gonna call me that, Solo? Back it up with your blaster, Wookhugger. I'll twerp your guts all over that sorry heap of junk you call a ship. Easy, furball. Paws where I can see them. No one's throwing down just yet. Still, if you want to start something, sure, I can shift my gun a little. Move the braids where you can see them. There you go. You like that? Take a good look. Friends of yours, maybe? Family? Smart critter. No reaction. Play it cool. Meanwhile, Solo plays for time. Same old song and dance. I'll pay you tomorrow for a charter I'm taking today. Garbage. He'll run at the first chance, and I'll chase him down. Fine by me. The more I work, the more I'll make Jabba pay for the pirate's head. Not that I really have anything against the big slug. His money's just as good as anyone's, and better than most. But business is business, and we both know to press the advantage when we have it. Mama Fett didn't raise any fools. Strictly speaking, my mama was a birthing pod, but you get the point. Still, I can't help but think Jabba considers me the closest thing he has to a friend. Well, closer anyway than that creepy suck-up Fortuna and that shrieking varmint he keeps for a pet. Some nights, when the lights are down in the palace and his scum buddies are snoozing, Jabba pulls out a bottle of his really prime brew, kicks Rebo awake, orders him to play something low and sad, and invites me to have a few. So I take off my helmet, but never my gun, and drink as he pours. And the hut talks a lot. Personal stuff, things no one else ever hears, stories of loves lost, enemies crushed, deals brokered then broken, regrets, possibly, things that eat at his soul if he's got one. Of course, I don't understand a word he says, but the drink is good, and the company, considering what Jabba pays, is tolerable. What, we're done? Jabba actually gave Solo an extension. Unbelievable. And after Solo fried Greedo and tromped on the slug's tail to boot, Jabba's getting soft. Either that, or he figures Solo's got ties to people with deeper pockets. Must be that. The hut can smell money. And he never misses a trick. You lead a charmed life, Solo. And I'd very much like to change that. You too, Wook. That auburn scalp of yours will make a fine trophy. Someday. Right now, Jabba just said, Baska. And when the boss says, Baska, we Baska. As long as he's in a generous mood, I'll hit him up for a mug of that fine brew. After today, I could use one.
You Owe Me a Ride by Zoraida Cordova. Bria Tonica couldn't remember where she was. Not at first. The stale stench of wine and lingering Halliot perfume on her skin helped her focus on the cracked bedroom walls smeared with stains, the origins of which she didn't want to try to guess. Still hungover, she recoiled from the noonday rays filtering through her window and let herself sink back into the hard mattress. Try as she might, she couldn't keep out the cacophony of merchant chatter and hissing transports. Over the years, Bria and her sister had stayed in some funky places, but the best room for rent in Mos Eisley's dusty port was only a fraction better than pitching a tent on one of Tatooine's vast sand dunes. The door opened and Bria reached for the blaster on the nightstand.
"You're finally up," Senny Tonica said.
Bria and Senny Tonica were alike in so many ways. They shared the same lean, muscular legs and braided dark hair, the same wide, expressive eyes and that roguish smirk when they set their sights on a mark. But the resemblance stopped there.
Sometimes Bria wished she could charm strangers the way Senny could with just a turn of her lovely head. Senny was tall, and her hair made her appear even taller. She found power in being able to look down at nearly anyone when negotiating contracts. Contracts that lately were few and far between, and fulfilling them not made easier with the arrival of Imperial troops snooping around. Bria sat up and grabbed a robe from the floor. Please tell me it's not more flatbread and beans. Senny kicked off her boots and hooked her cloak on the back of the door. She threw the fiber bag across the small room. Two beds, a shower, and a table for their weapons. That's all they needed.
It's not more beans?
Senny said, trying to keep a straight face as her twin ripped open the bag of food to find fresh loaves of flatbread. Bria ripped off a piece and shoved it between her lips, still smeared with her favorite metallic lipstick. I hate this place, she said, finally getting out of bed. She sat at the table covered with blasters and rifles. She picked up her favorite pistol. The metal was the blue of Ithorian roses.
We could stay at the palace, Senny said. You know Jabba has always taken a liking to you.
Us, Bria said, chewing rudely to make her sister cringe. And simply because the word palace is in its description does not a palace make.
Speaking of overstuffed snot, his royal slug has a job.
What is it?
If I knew, I wouldn't be sitting here watching you nurse your hangover.
I feel perfect. Senny threw her head back and cackled.
If it weren't for me, you would have made out with a Rhodian pirate last night.
Bria grimaced, trying to recall the night. But there was only darkness. Darkness was better than the memories that threatened to push their way to the forefront of her thoughts. Blood and guns and jobs gone so south she wasn't sure she'd ever recover. Memories like that didn't have place in the present. So she did as her sister asked and showered, the water tepid and smelling of chemicals she couldn't name. When she was ready, she stood in front of Senny, who without speaking zipped up the back of her bodysuit. Each sister carried a pistol at her hip and a knife in her boot. They put on their cloaks and headed out into the dry, suffocating street, where it was nearly impossible not to inhale dust. They hopped on a speeder and zoomed toward Jabba's palace. Bria and Senny watched the suns set from atop a rock formation. Tatooine might be a desert wasteland lacking in any culinary delicacies, but few things in the galaxy compared to the brilliance of its sunsets. The Tonica sisters stalked down the cavernous corridor that led to the dank hall where Jabba held court. The royal slug's body odor was impossible to miss. Bria always pinched the bridge of her nose until she was able to stand the smells, but Senny wasn't fazed by things like comfort. She wanted to get on with the next job, mainly because their accounts were nearly depleted and their faces were in every criminal database in the galaxy. So Senny Tonica held her head high, her braids swishing around her broad shoulders like fringe as she walked in. They wore different colored suits, Bria's blue and Senny's acid green, and waded through the crowds, returning the cordial nods that were thrown in their direction. Jabba was still hidden under shadow, slumbering the way he did no matter how loudly the court bustled around him. Bria ordered two Tatooine sunsets from a waitress, ignoring her sister's glare, and they picked an empty spot against a wall where they could watch.
Ugh,
Bria muttered under her breath. Since they were little, they'd developed a way of speaking without many words. Bria's dark eyes flitted across the room where Bib Fortuna stalked around the band. His bright red eyes sent shivers down Bria's spine. Senny touched her sister's shoulder but steeled her features.
Not long.
But it was a long time before Jabba deigned to wake up, despite having been the one to call the gathering. No one questioned him. No one complained that they'd been waiting and waiting, or that the band was recycling songs it had played when they first arrived. Bria drank another tall orange and pink drink, smiled at a Wookiee with a great scar across his face, and watched the Twi'lek girl twirl her delicate wrists to the rhythm of the horns. It wasn't the music that woke Jabba, but the growl of the rancor that lived in the cage beneath his throne. Senny and Bria glanced at each other, then at the other bounty hunters in attendance. There was a moment of stillness. The Max Rebo band was dead silent. A deep grumble echoed in the bowels of the palace, and Bria felt her heart quicken because she knew what would happen when Jabba moved his throne back and opened the hatch. She'd seen hunters and slaves of any and all species plunge into the deep dark beneath and never come out. Instead of feeding his pet, Jabba opened the wide slit of his drooling mouth and laughed.
"Gather around, my friends,"
Jabba ordered in Huttese. He turned his serpent eyes on the band and said,
"Did I ask you to stop playing?"
Max set his fat blue digits to pressing the keys of his organ, and an upbeat tune played in the background as every bounty hunter present stepped closer to Jabba's throne. Senny stood in front of her sister as if she could shield her with her body. She looked from side to side at the others in attendance. Among her peers, she wasn't someone's sister and she wasn't some orphan. No, she was a hunter and a thief and a smuggler. She was capable of many things, even if Bria was the one whose mugshot was listed in the criminal database for murder. Whatever this job was, Senny would do it because they needed to get far away, where they wouldn't be recognized and their names wouldn't be flagged on scans. They could get off this world and have what passed as a normal life. For that, they needed credits. Lots of them. And only Jabba offered that kind of currency.
"As many of you know,"
Jabba began in his guttural voice,
"Han Solo lost my cargo. He has ignored my summons. I want him brought to me. My sources tell me he is seeking to get off planet as soon as he can. Whoever brings Solo to me alive will be rewarded."
There was a bevy of murmurs. A dark-haired hunter wearing a black jacket looked at Bria and then at Senny. But the sisters kept quiet and waited. The scar-faced Wookiee stepped forward. The sisters didn't understand his wailing speech, but whatever he said made Jabba laugh again. Bria watched the royal slug throw his slimy head back, his tail wiggling happily, and she wondered if he ever stopped laughing. She shifted beneath the nervous ripple in the crowd because she knew what would come next. Senny grabbed her sister's hand and they took a step back. The latch opened beneath the Wookiee's feet and his scream was the flat note of a horn.
"Bring me Solo,"
Jabba said when the Wookiee's cry died down. And then there were only the jingling tunes of the band and the crunching of bone between the Rancor's teeth. Bria and Senny discussed the job over and over again through the night and into the next morning.
"I say he won't come with us," Bria said.
"He can't still be mad about the Lando ordeal. It was his idea."
Bria wanted to correct her sister. There were many things that had happened between them and the cocky smuggler. Maybe not friendship, but there was history. When Jabba put out a prize like that, he was pitting a whole lot of rancors against one another. Why shouldn't the sisters be the ones to come out triumphant?
"It doesn't matter," Bria said. "Solo is going to take one look at us and bolt. He won't come willingly."
"Then we won't take him willingly."
Senny licked her lips coquettishly.
"Have you forgotten his Wookiee bodyguard? Senny, it's Han. If he's got any brains in that thick skull of his, he's already fixing to run.
We'll find another job." Senny crossed her arms and scoffed stubbornly.
"Oh, yeah? When?"
"I don't know, but..."
"But nothing. When did you go soft for Solo, anyway? You've been cursing his name across the galaxy for years. We need a fast ship, and to get that, we need credits. Someone is going to bring him in. Why shouldn't it be us?"
"I get it," Bria said, her brow furrowed. She was surprised at Senny. "I have a debt to pay Solo, but I've never been brave enough to go through with it. After all, he was responsible for my greatest humiliation, and that I'll never, ever forget." Senny was startled by her own thoughtlessness. How could she have mistaken her sister's hesitation for concern?
It's your call. This could be our chance to have what we've always wanted.
In their cramped room in the heart of Mos Eisley, Bria and Senny Tonica faced each other from the edges of their twin beds. What we've always wanted. Freedom. Peace. Life. Everyone knew how people like them ended up. Blown up, in prison, or on the wrong end of a blaster. Then Bria made that face she always made when she was up to no good. Because they could have it all. The freedom and the peace of mind. All of it. I have a better idea, she told Senny, who quirked a single brow.
This isn't like the time we broke into House Organa's palace to lift the royal jewels and had to hide in a dumpster for two nights, is it?
Bria rolled her eyes. For the last time, I got a bad tip. How was I supposed to know the housemaids don't wear orange?
Or the time...
Enough, Bria said, and this time her sister listened. We can have it all. The ship, the credits, and we won't get our limbs ripped off in the process.
How?
Let's steal the Falcon. When Bria Tonica stepped into Chalmers' cantina, she felt just as she had during her first con back on Kifex. Her palms were sweating and her heart was racing out of her chest. Back then, she and Senny had been trying to break a friend out of a detention center. Back then, no credits had been involved, just duty. Everything had gone smoothly until a guard came back to his post early and caught them. Bria stayed behind to give them cover, and her sweaty, nervous hands shot to kill. It was only her on the footage. After that, they had no choice but to go off-world. To run and keep running until there came a day when they would have a place to call home that wasn't a dank, rented room or a freighter ship. It's the fastest ship in the galaxy, Bria pleaded with her sister.
That's what Han says, and everyone's too scared to challenge him. Besides, Jabba's reward could buy a dozen fast ships.
They looked down at the same time, as if they were sharing the same thought. The rancor devouring the Wookiee at Jabba's palace. It wasn't the first time they'd seen the creature in action, but every time they hoped it would be the last. Bria wondered if she could really leave Solo to that fate. She steeled her heart because taking care of Senny would always come first. Senny sighed and said,
I don't know. Solo would probably rather take his chances with the entire Empire than give up his ship.
He's a rat roach, Bria said and chuckled. I know he's somewhere on this dirt ball trying to find a new soul to swindle. But we've got to act now, Sen. We have to beat Jabba's men to the ship. The place is crawling with stormtroopers. If it goes south, there is no way I'm taking work from the Empire, not after what they've done to our kind.
You're a hunter, Senny reminded her. You don't get to choose where your job comes from.
If this is our last job, then yes, we can choose. So they chose. Bria cut a path through the tightly packed dark aisles of the tavern and settled at the bar. Wooher, the bartender, barely looked in their direction before he pulled on a draft handle and set two tall glasses in front of them. Not one for pleasantries, he grumbled his hello and stalked off to take another order.
There he is,
Senny whispered into her sister's ear. A couple of regulars cozied up beside them, already in their cups, tapping their feet to the jumping rhythm of the band. Senny smiled and delighted two locals with stories of a job they had worked in the Canto Bight Casino. Meanwhile, Bria watched the crowd. A man in a brown robe walked in and struck up a conversation with a pilot. Beside her, Senny laughed and was her usual charming self.
I tell you, I can't get anything done with those helmet heads parading about,
one of the locals told Bria, his thick bottom lip drooping.
Never seen anything like it,
another one said. That piqued Senny's interest, and she joined the conversation. From farmers to merchants, no one on Tatooine was pleased with the recent arrival of stormtroopers.
What are they after?
She asked.
Droids, sounds like,
the man said.
I've got a mess of them piled up in my shed if they want droids.
Bria glanced at her sister and shared a frown for a moment before recommencing her careful scan of the cantina. She noticed a young farmer walk in. His hair was the shade of beaten gold, and even in the dark of the room, she could see how bright his eyes were. There was an innocence about him as he asked his droids to wait outside, then walked up to the bar beside the old man in the brown robe. Bria liked him for some inexplicable reason. He had the kind of innocence she and Senny never could. Then Bria grabbed her sister's arm. Docking Bay, 94.
Something strange is happening,
Senny told her twin as they raced through the crowded Mos Eisley streets. Each sandstone building looked exactly like the next. Each person wore a cloak to protect themselves from the sand and the dust. It was the perfect port to get lost in if one truly wanted to. Something strange is always happening, Bria said.
First, there's so much heat on this speck of rock.
It's a desert, of course there's heat.
You know what I mean. I think something terrible is going to happen.
Bria sidestepped a kid racing on a hoverbike. She would have yelled at him if she didn't have somewhere to be. Listen to me, she said to Senny. Terrible things will always happen. They happened on Kifex, and they happened on Naboo, and they happened on Tatooine. There will always be a war, and there will always be someone who wants us locked up. But the only thing we can do is survive, Sen. Survive until they won't let us. They got to Docking Bay 94, and there she was. The Millennium Falcon. Dirty and in need of a shine, but the Tonica sisters knew how fast she could go. In that moment, they had the same memory of seemingly endless nights aboard the most magnificent hunk of junk in the galaxy. But that was the past. Memories.
Do you remember how to work the control panels?
Senny asked Bria. Bria shrugged, but a quirk at her lip betrayed her thoughts. Lando taught me a thing or two. They took a step toward the Falcon, but a familiar laugh stopped them cold. Jabba. Bria yanked her sister to the side and hid around a stack of crates.
Blast!
Senny hissed.
How many?
Bria asked. Senny shook her head. She propped herself up and stole a glance from over the top of the crates. There were Jabba and a handful of bounty hunters guarding the Falcon like a pack of womp rats. There were too many of them, all concentrated around the entrance to the ship. There was no way they could get on board now. Stealing the Falcon while there was a price on Solo's head would be like stealing from Jabba himself, but it would have been worth it. Bria cursed herself for not acting faster, for letting her hesitation drag her down. They were too late. Why send hunters out for Solo if he knew where he was the whole time? Bria wondered.
I told you, something strange is happening. We have to get off-world.
Our ride is a little off-limits,
Bria whisper hissed.
We'll find another way. We always do.
Bria thought back to the time they stowed away on a ship belonging to the Onaka gang, or the time they were stranded in wild space, or the time they trashed their room on Coruscant just to get back at Lando. Senny was right. They always found another way. Bria smiled at her sister and waited for the coast to be clear. As soon as Jabba and his men weren't looking in their direction, they slipped back out the door and onto the crowded street. Bria and Senny Tonica needed to regroup. Find another way to break free. It seemed as if that life they wanted was as distant as the outermost ring of the galaxy. But for now, as they ducked into a nearby alleyway, they had each other.
You owe me a ride,
Senny told her sister after a long silence. Bria wanted to say that she owed her more than that. They waited to see Jabba's next move, but a scuffle broke out on the streets. Bria lifted her hood back up to see what the commotion was about. She kept close to the wall and saw a group of stormtroopers march by with rifles at the ready. Their presence ignited a wave of chatter among the street dwellers and locals who watched them run into Docking Bay 94. In the flurry of the moment, dozens of bodies were clamoring to see the stormtroopers in action. Their distraction brought a spark to Bria's eyes. The docking bays nearby were left unmanned. Any ship in Jabba's position would sell handsomely, and if this was their last score, they were going out in style.
What is it?
Senny whispered into her sister's ear, craning her neck like so many others. We're getting off this rock. Bria smirked as she grabbed her sister's hand and led her back into the street, knowing quite well they couldn't stop running until they were surrounded by the stars.
The Secrets of Long Snoot by Delilah S. Dawson.
Do you know what your problem is, Long Snoot?
The human elbows me, as if unsure he has my attention, and I allow it. What's that? I say. His language is difficult for me to speak, inelegantly forced through two sets of teeth and out of my sensitive snout. An organ that can express 1,000 emotions in my own language with a mere twitch.
You're a stuck-up spy. Immoral and arrogant at the same time. See, you can be one or the other, but you can't be both.
He swigs the acid he considers a beverage. The fumes make my snout wrinkle.
Think you're better than us? Pretend you're not rich. Sit around the cantina like you fit in. But you're just another alien. Sticking your ugly mug where it don't belong.
My snout wrinkles. An elegant poem he can't read. I will take that into consideration. The human snorts and stands.
Jeez! Don't even know when you're being insulted. Not even smart enough to take offense!
He wobbles off to another table filled with raucous humans. They're laughing at me now. At a strange creature with a long snoot who hides behind robes and goggles. Their species grates on my nerves. Noisy, rude, unsubtle, uneducated. Especially in the rougher corners of a planet like Tatooine. Their sweat stinks of fear and desperation. They're as trapped here as I am. Although they tell themselves they chose this life. Know what your problem is? I say in my own language, quietly and to myself. Your problem is that your entire species thinks itself a sun around which the petty planets and moons spin. But really, you're just another rock, doomed to ever orbit something grander, but remain ignorant of your own insignificance. He wouldn't understand that, even if I said it in his language. Soon, he'll discover that his leather bag of credits is gone. That, at least, is a language he understands. He was wrong about the rich part, you see. When I first came here, they called me Long Snoot. No one asked my name or species, which I at first considered the height of discourtesy. Soon I learned that it was a protective measure among thieves and felons, all hiding out here on a planet that's not worth searching. Did I tell them my name is Garindin Ezaver, and that I come from a respectable hive on Kubindi, or that my clan is known for breeding and farming a sought-after strain of succulent picolet beetle? Did I tell them my children are well-known senators, orators, and artists? That my grandchildren fill the creches and academies to bring future glory to our hive? No, I did not. For one, because no one asked. For another, because their petty thoughts don't matter. They are merely scavengers run to ground by a bigger predator. Fate chased us all here. But it won't keep me here much longer. I look down at my data pad, checking my accounts. Yesterday I was wealthy by any standard. Then a robed spy offered me a garbled comm message from Kubindi. I haven't heard my own language in years, and I was more than willing to pay the substantial amount she demanded.
Father, come home,
my daughter said, her pain thrumming in every tone.
Mother is dead, and the family is in trouble.
The message cut off. The stranger disappeared. My account dipped to nearly nothing. I didn't care. After that, my entire focus changed. Before, I was quietly building my account to return home with riches at a time of my leisure. Then I could begin the process of freeing Kubindi from the control of the lying empire. Now I have about 3 standard days to scrape together enough intel and creds to get me off this planet and back home, where I must bury my mate with full honors and regain control of my clan. But my network is large, and I've already arranged for an informant to supply the codes I need to get home. The time is nigh, so I adjust my hood and goggles and slip out of the cantina, leaving 1/2 credit out for the bartender, Wooher, one of the least offensive humans I know. It is a pleasure to be outside, free from the stench of the drunken, poorly washed fools. The light on this planet would blind me if I took off my goggles, but the scent of the night air is pleasurable. The sand scours the wind clean, and I always curl my snout with joy at the clear mineral freshness of it. Moments later, I'll adjust, and the odor of dewbacks and rontos will hit me, beak and warm, plus the smaller notes of fusty jawas and the oily clank of metal. It's like a symphony the way the scents flow anew with each breeze. But it only makes me long all the more for Kubindi, for the odors that speak of home. I haven't tasted dainty la ville pâté or robust beech legs in ages. The only thing sweeter will be rubbing snouts with my children and meeting the new grandchildren, of which I'm sure there will be many. I snatch a night moth from the air and try to swallow it before the vile taste hits me. Me, reduced to eating moths. The air grows stale as I hurry through alleys and under billowing fabric tents. The humans narrow their eyes at me, their flesh radiating the sense of distrust and anxiety. They see me as a monster from their nightmares, a hideous, dishonest creature that lives to swindle and degrade them. If only they could understand that I see them exactly the same way, but with the added bonus of slavery and oppression. I am here only because their people brought me here and abandoned me. They are here by choice. I reach the meeting place first and put my back against the rough clay dwelling, sending my senses out into the night. I smell thieves counting creds, murderers with blood still on their hands, enforcers with smoking blasters, females drenched in hopelessness, starving children, and 100 different species sleeping fretfully behind locked doors. This is normal in the slums of a place like Tatooine. All the honorable life happens farther out, on respectable moisture farms. Things I never smell here include the tang of fresh oil paint, the resin flaking off an instrument's plucked strings, the nutty zing of ink, or the powdery cosmetics painted on actors waiting behind dusty curtains. Of all the places for cultured kubals to end up, it's ironic that it's on a planet bereft of arts, decorum, and education. Not that it matters. I'll be gone soon. I smell my informant before I see him. He's human, because of course he is. Nervous, sweating. His flesh still redolent of the armor he's worn all day, while tromping around, cajoling, and intimidating and killing his own kind, on an order he doesn't fully understand, and never questions. I was never that naive. It's the nature of my species to question. It just so happens that I didn't question the right things. And that's how I came to be here. He's jumpy, and he's still wearing a blaster. The less I speak, the more comfortable he will feel. So I simply hold out the worn purse of Dubek leather I snatched from my unkind neighbor in the cantina, jingling it slightly in my glove. That noise propels him forward.
"Turn it out so I can see,"
he whispers. It's a foolish demand. There are too many credits here, more than I can hold in my hands. But I pour out enough to satisfy him. Even through the goggles, I can see his bulbous eyes gleaming. Just as I want something, so does he. We are both willing to do underhanded things to make it happen. I wonder what purpose this money will serve. Perhaps a crime boss has stolen the dancing girl he thinks he loves. Or maybe his child is sitting in irons in the market. Maybe he, too, just wants to escape the lies of the Empire. It doesn't matter. I tuck the coins back into the bag, and he snatches it without touching my glove and hands me a slip of paper with several codes scribbled in basic. These will get me past the blockade? I ask. He jerks back when he hears my voice. I've been told it reminds humans of the whine of insects. Which makes sense, as I am descended from insects. They'll never question that I have gone to the trouble to learn their entire language, while not a single one has bothered to learn my name. If I told him his voice reminds me of the hooting complaints of a Kowakian monkey lizard, he'd probably shoot me where I stand.
The codes are good, at least for a few days. It would be best if you were on a ship with no guns. Some sort of traitor. Nothing the rebels would fly.
When he says the word rebels, he spits in the sand. And I can smell his moisture soaking up the dust. So this one, he still thinks his people are the good guys. Your friend is about to get jumped, I observe. And he pulls his hood down and spins. A soft thump and cry around the corner send him running toward the compatriot who watched his back during our exchange. My work is done, and I melt into the night. The scent of their blood follows me. Even for villains, this place is dangerous. I live here, but I would not call this place a home. My people build beautifully complex hives, each person curling in their own tight cell at night to dream the dreams of grubs. My hovel on Tatooine feels both too small to be a home and too big to be a sleeping cell. Someone stored beasts here once, but I prefer their lingering odor to that of humans and the other sentient creatures who surround me. Beasts have honest interests, most of them pertaining to the physical drives dictated by their body chemistry. Their odors are predictable, harmless, dependable. But people emit thousands of pheromones in their secretions, their thoughts and feelings laid down like the whispered conversations that mar a concert. Tatooine is no place for a thinking being who relies on unspoken communication, especially when the communicators are unaware of how they lie to themselves. It is unfortunate that my business keeps me waiting for hours in cantinas, the air thick with lust and greed and fear. Perhaps this is why they hate me. somewhere deep down. They know someone is listening. I lock my door as everyone else does. My blue light is calming, and I buzz a sigh as I finally remove my hood and goggles. I worry that when I return to Kubindi, my family and friends will focus on the unattractive ridges worn into my flesh by this disguise. The lines of tight leather pressing around my snout and drawing circles around my eyes. My hair will stand up straight, but parts of me will feel as if they droop. Among the Kubas, little can be hidden, and I will be out of practice. My datapad pings, alerting me to a new bounty. I must be choosy. For all of my strengths, I have many weaknesses, and I only select jobs that keep them hidden. No hand-to-hand combat, no kidnapping, no killing, no guarding. I rarely use my blaster, but make a point of letting everyone see it. Information is my currency. Unfortunately, that's exactly what's currently desired. The Empire has placed a high bounty on any information leading it to two droids. One is golden, one is squat. Tomorrow morning I'll find them. My snout wiggles with glee. The high price on this last job will pay for my passage off the planet and back to Kubindi. It means that the very Empire that lured me from my home with false promises is effectively paying to return me to my planet. In the creche, our instructors taught us of our history with the Empire and the Rebellion. The Empire was our friend, but the rebels had long sabotaged our technological advances to keep us off-planet. If we helped them, the Empire promised to help us gain a foothold in galactic trade and politics. The cunning protocol droids who spoke for the Empire on Kubindi were carefully bathed in hot oil before doddering down the ship's ramps to meet with our elders and proudly lead us into the belly of their grand vessel as our people buzzed a cheer. We could not detect their lies. I was one of the chosen students picked from the academy to study under the Empire as a diplomat and return to my mate and hive with new accolades. At least, that's what they told us. Instead, I was indentured and trained as a spy. My ability to read body language, smell pheromones and weapons, and hear from long distances was to become a mere tool in the hand of galaxy-wide tyranny. My 50 companions and I were put in manacles and forced to withstand propaganda, indoctrination, and reprogramming. Mine, as might be guessed, did not take. I slipped away on a job and attempted to return to Kubindi, only to find its orbit guarded by Imperial firepower. Since then, I've been working quietly and steadily to create my current reality. After this job, I will have enough credits to hire a ship. I now have Imperial codes to get me past the blockade. And I have a datapad crammed with the most current information, diagrams, and manuals on advanced technology and hyperspace travel. When I return to Kubindi, my people will finally learn that the Empire holds them hostage, keeping them from a much wider universe and sabotaging their every effort to get off-planet. I'll also have the intel necessary to build weapons that can shoot their buzzing TIE fighters out of the sky. Tomorrow, I will find the droids. I will collect the bounties
and then I will leave. My day begins in Chalman's Cantina. La Bria, the Deveronian, is already here, hiding his pointy smile and tapping his fingers to music no one else can hear.